Hello, this is David Starr. Welcome to the Pluralcast. Today's guest is the venerable K. Scott Allen, who will be helping us understand that big release of new tools that just came out of the web development teams there at Microsoft. Most notably, we'll be talking about the MVC3 release and all that that entails. Now, before we get to our discussion with Scott Allen, I'm really excited because this episode kicks off a brand new Pluralcast feature. For each episode, a visit from Kate Gregory, our local Visual Studio extensibility expert in residence, in which she'll be helping us become more aware of many of those useful Visual Studio add-ins and extensions and all that good stuff that's out there in the Visual Studio gallery. These things are accessible right from our extension manager inside Visual Studio. And the biggest problem I have is not knowing that they're there in the first place, and that's where Kate comes in. She's going to be helping us separate the wheat from the chaff. Okay, so Kate, what do you have for us this week?
I thought I'd start at the corner of two things that I care a lot about, which is Visual Studio extensibility and Windows 7 goodies and features. And on top of that, there's a good chance that this extension was written in C++, which would totally put it at the intersection of everything I care about. It's called Win7 Taskbar Extension, and if you search for Taskbar on the Visual Studio Gallery, it's going to be in your first five hits. And it's free, of course, and it's written by Dmitry Sitnikov, and it gives a little bit more taskbar integration to Visual Studio 2010. Already, Visual Studio 2010 lets you right-click on that icon and choose from solutions you've opened recently, which is great. It beats the heck out of what the older versions of Visual Studio do on Windows 7. But that's all it does is have destinations. It doesn't have any tasks, and it doesn't have any sort of extra communication with you through the taskbar. And that's the hole that this little extension fills, is communicating through the taskbar. And it really only does two things. While you're building, it puts a progress bar, which in my experience is almost always an indeterminate waving progress bar, in the taskbar icon, let you know that the build is still in progress. And when your build is finished, if there were any warnings or any errors, it puts a little icon overlay on your taskbar. And so especially if you have a project that takes 15 or 20 minutes to build, you can just put Visual Studio into the background and glance down there and know where you stand.
Well, in the time that you spent describing this add-in, I installed it. So that was easy.
That's how it's supposed to be, you know? It's just as simple as that. My only thing that would keep me from making this a five-star extension is that it does not install through the extension manager. It's a task, it's a control panel kind of an experience if you want to uninstall it. But why would I want to uninstall it? I like what it does, and I'm a happy camper.
Right on. Thanks, Kate. Okay, so let's get to our discussion with Scott. And I'll start by asking simply, Scott, what's your favorite new thing in the MVC3 box?
To me, the biggest improvement in MVC3 is the view engine, the new view engine, which is Razor, which isn't specifically tied to MVC. And there's certainly been other view engines available in MVC, but I happen to like Razor the best now.
I've heard you mention that the Razor view engine really doesn't have anything to do with MVC other than that the MVC framework understands it, that the Razor framework actually can stand alone and is used just as a templating engine.
Right. I'm sure when they were designing Razor, they had MVC in mind, and the MVC framework, they shipped a view engine that understands how to work with Razor. But it's also my understanding there was actually some debate as to whether Razor should be in a system.something.web namespace at all, or if it should be in a higher level namespace or a different namespace or something that wasn't tied to web even. Because you can use Razor views with Web Matrix, another tool that you can create web pages with. But and Razor itself is pretty well geared towards working with some sort of markup language so that you can intermingle C# code and XML or HTML or something with angle brackets. But theoretically, you could take a Razor view or a Razor file and generate the text for an email message for it. And you could do that either by having the Razor file parsed and compiled at runtime, or you could even build a custom tool that plugs into Visual Studio so that it works a bit like T4, and you drop a Razor file in your project, it spits out a .cs file, and then you just build and you have another class that's been generated for you.
And when you say they, you are talking about Microsoft, right? This is a Microsoft-grown technology.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a open source project that Microsoft's taken and adopted.
Right. This was all implemented inside of Microsoft, and it has all the integration you would expect. So when you have a Razor view, you have IntelliSense and debugging and all sorts of things like that.
One of the things that strikes me looking at the Razor syntax and what little exposure I've had, I'll admit, is that there seem to be just a lot fewer keystrokes needed to express the same intent. Just a lot less typing, basically. What's your take on that?
It's considerable. It's considerably easier to write, and it's considerably easier on the eyes to consume also. Now, some people I know still prefer other view engines, like the Spark view engine that's been around for quite a while, because it really blends together C# code and HTML. And the goal of both of these was just let's make it easier to have C# code in a view. Not big blocks of C# code, but when you're writing a view using the Model View Controller framework, you want a very simple view, but you still need tiny code snippets to say output first name here and output last name here. And it was very cumbersome to use the WebForms view engine to do that because of all the less than percent colon signs, and then you had to close that off. Whereas view engines like Razor and Spark try to allow you to just plop in some C# code without explicitly typing any sort of delimiter to say, here is C# code. The parsers just automatically pick it up.
One of the things we love is the integration that we get with some of these view engines in Visual Studio, IntelliSense integration in particular. Can I get that with Spark and Razor? Is that there?
I believe the state of Spark is that you can have IntelliSense for your C# code, or you can have IntelliSense for your HTML markup, but you do not have both. And in Razor, you still get both.
Okay.
And it does it pretty good. And so the neat thing about Razor is that when you're writing a view, you can just write your HTML and C# code and not worry too much about what's going to be legal and what's going to be illegal. Just know that when you start writing C# code, you just put in an @ and start writing an expression or a block. And for the most part, Razor just always figures it out. It does the right thing.
Have you had an opportunity to pull the Razor templating system out and use it separate from MVC so that you use it to create some other type of text file, code, or whatever?
Yes. I had a client who needed to generate some text from a template, and the obvious first choice was T4, but when I took a look at the way Razor worked, it was relatively straightforward to implement a custom build tool that when you add a Razor template to a folder and set its properties to use that custom build tool, it spits out a CS file that you can use. So you could use Razor to not just to produce a web page, but also to produce, you could produce like an email.
Anything text-based, it sounds like, really.
Any sort of text, but it is going to work better with markup-type languages.
You know, it's interesting what you're proposing, because the templating system most of us are familiar with, T4, it's just so crufty, you know? There's so much in there, so much crufty syntax, and I wonder if this opportunity with templating Razor gives us a new way to think about generating code, C# files, VB, whatever.
Yes, yep, and that's exactly what I did. Because if you think about the way Razor works, it's and you know anything about how ASPX files work, and even the T4 templates work, it's exactly the same thing. Something comes along and parses what's inside of your TT file or your CSHTML Razor file or your ASPX web form file, and it generates C# code from it. And then what you do with that C# code is up to you. If you want that C# code in your project, then you're going to want to parse those templates before you even do a compile, much the way T4 sort of defaults to work. The way MVC would use a Razor view, though, is more traditionally like you would use web forms, where at runtime, something walks up to the CSHTML file, produces C# code, compiles it into an assembly, and then executes it to produce HTML for your view. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Okay. All right, so Razor's super cool. What else is in the box?
I kind of like the dependency resolver. Maybe this isn't a feature that is too well-known or documented or many people know about, but one of the things that the MVC framework was always criticized for was its lack of, adopting a stance that a lot of developers are going to use an inversion of control container. So the MVC framework has a lot of different extensibility points. You can plug in custom view engines. You can plug in custom controller factories, custom metadata providers, all these different pieces. But the extensibility points to add your own custom implementation of these things into the runtime, it was a different API for each of those. What they did in MVC 3 was took a step back and said, let's have a central component called the dependency resolver. And anytime the MVC framework needs to get something like a view engine, a controller activator, even action filters, the MVC runtime will go to the dependency resolver and essentially say, get me this service, or get me these services, plural. And the default dependency resolver that comes with the MVC framework is just going to return null or allow the default things to happen inside of the MVC framework, the default controller factory, the default view engine, and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
With me? But so what you can do, which you weren't able to do before if you use an inversion of control container for dependency injection, is you can write your own custom dependency resolver, plug that into the MVC framework, and now literally every single service and component and object that the MVC runtime needs, it'll come through your custom dependency resolver, and you can simply forward calls to your inversion of control container, whether it's Ninject or StructureMap or Unity. And that means extensibility with the MVC framework now is really easy. When you want to implement a custom view engine, just put it in your container. If you want to implement a custom controller factory, you just plug it in the container.
Huh. You know, the way you're describing this, it sounds like the resolver is sort of a dynamic type generator all its own, almost like its own IOC, if you will.
I'd say it's more like the common service locator. Are you familiar with that project on CodePlex?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so the idea behind the common service locator was that you had all these middle tier-ish type of frameworks out there, things by people who are implementing open source frameworks, and they're all trying to be extensible. They all really do want to use an inversion of control container somewhere, but of course no one can quite decide on what is the inversion of control container to use everywhere. We'd never be able to decide that, right? One person's going to like to always use Unity from Microsoft. Some other project always wants to use StructureMap. Some other project wants to use Ninject. And it was creating a point of contention in the community about how to resolve this problem. How do we abstract all inversion of control containers so that we can define an interface that everyone will use to talk to an inversion of control container? Is that making sense?
I think so, yeah. Sort of an interface of interfaces, if you will.
Exactly. So, most inversion of control containers, I guess, I don't know if we should explain what they are, but, you know, if you watch the Pluralsight patterns library, I'm sure you'll find out about them. If most inversion of control containers, what you do is you walk up to them and you say, give me something that implements this type or this interface, and they'll give you back an object. Or you walk up to them and say, give me all the objects you know about that implement this interface, and it'll give you a collection of objects. That's essentially the primary responsibility of an inversion control container at runtime, once it's been configured and so forth. So a bunch of people in the community got together, and also Glenn Bach and Chris Tavares and a couple of the Microsoft Patterns and Practices people said, let's define the interface of all interfaces, the common service locator. And now anyone who is anyone is writing a framework that wants people to be able to plug in their own container. All they need to do is, you know, work against this interface, and we'll have implementations for all the different inversion of control containers. In the end, I'm actually not sure how well the Common Service Locator is doing. The MVC framework didn't want to take a dependency on it. I'm not actually sure where all it's being used at this point.
It's funny. It sort of sounds like we're hearkening a little bit back to iUnknown.
Yeah, very similar. So essentially, the whole point of that was that the dependency resolver is really what I would call the Common Service Locator. It's just, in the MVC runtime, it's an interface that has two methods, get service or get services. And if you want to use an inversion of control container, all you need to do is implement that interface and forward those calls to your inversion of control container. It's typically, literally, just, you know, one line of code inside of each method. It's really just a funk or a shim, if you would.
I'm going to try something here, and I bet I have the wrong idea, but could I register a typical service class type with the dependency resolver and get it back the way I would normally register my types with an IOC?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Because in the end, if you're using an IOC container, it's probably what's sitting behind the dependency resolver in MVC. See, the thing about the dependency resolver, it's usually like this. Let's say I have a controller, and that controller needs an iMessenger or an iRepository or an iLogger in its constructor, right?
Perfect.
So you're doing the traditional dependency injection. You have a non-default constructor that says, I need an iLogger. In your test, you could still instantiate that home controller and pass in a fake logger or use a mock object framework and construct something to pass in an iLogger, right?
That works, yep.
And at runtime, production time, the interesting thing that happens is this. When the MVC framework gets information from the routing engine that says, oh, you need to send this request to the home controller, then what the MVC runtime will do is it will actually consult with the dependency resolver to say, can you give me a home controller? And when you have your IOC container wired up to everything and configured properly, your IOC container is going to be the one that hands out the home controller to the MVC framework, and it's been properly instantiated with the iLogger or iMessenger that you configured into the container. Does that make sense?
It does. It does.
So what it really means, if I'm trying to find a simple way to explain this, it really means that the MVC framework can use your IOC container.
You know, some of these ideas are really hard to talk about when we don't have a whiteboard to draw on and point at and gesticulate.
Exactly.
You know? One of the things that is in that MVC announcement set that has come out is this notion of IIS 7, I guess, 7.5 Express. Is this a replacement or the evolution of Cassini, the InVisual Studio web server that we use for development? Is it intended to take the place of Cassini?
Well, it is like Cassini in the sense that it can stand alone and run into your system tray and run with your credentials, and you don't need to be a super user administrator to get this thing configured or running on your system. In that sense, it is like Cassini, but it's really built from the same code as IIS. So you're literally running just like SQL Express is really just SQL Server. This is really just IIS, but it doesn't need to run as, you know, you don't need to be an administrator and open up an MMC to create a virtual directory and do things like that.
Okay, so rather than installing IIS on my dev box because I'm a dev and I need a web server, this is what I'll be looking for instead of that standard IIS.
Right, this is the alternative. So this is Microsoft trying to simplify things for web developers. And SQL Server Express was sort of one step in that direction, but that was from the SQL Server team. That was just saying, you know, here's a really easy way to run SQL Server. Just have an MDF file that's sitting on the file system, and you just, you know, you can open it up without going into some sort of SQL Server configuration manager and attaching some database that's in a magic location under the program files directory, you know, that sort of thing. IIS Express was just trying to make things easier for developers, so you don't need the full-blown IIS installed, but everything still behaves like IIS inside.
Have you been developing on IIS Express?
I haven't, actually. I've tried it out a few times and it's going to be great. But, you know, the thing is right now I have IIS installed everywhere.
Right, right.
And I haven't had a good reason to use it yet. And, you know, it'd be interesting, actually. It does run on XP, and one particular client that I work at still uses XP as a desktop, which drives me insane. But might have to try it out there.
Okay, so when I'm running this thing, does it run as a service like IIS, or does it run as a separate standalone app?
It's a standalone app.
Okay, so I guess that's our biggest difference right there, isn't it?
Right. It's something that you could run from the command line, right?
Right. Well, I guess we got off topic a little bit there, but it was just fascinating to know what in the world's going on with IIS Express.
Oh, no, that's okay.
I understand there is this idea of scaffolding or something called scaffolding in the MVC 3 release. What's that all about?
Yeah, this isn't out of the box with MVC. However, it's very easy to get through NuGet, which we can also talk about what NuGet is. But the idea behind scaffolding is that you can have something that quickly builds out the skeleton of an application for you. So this comes sort of from the Rails world, where you can scaffold up controllers and views and so forth. So with the way this would work with MVC, and I've only tried this a little bit, is that you can install this scaffolding for MVC, open up essentially a command prompt inside of Visual Studio, and you could say something like scaffold out a movie controller against this model. And what it will do is build out your controller with all the methods that you need to list, detail, edit, create movies. It'll build out the four views that you need: the index view, the edit view, the create view, the details view. It'll just, you know, plop all that stuff into your project and give you a starting point to go in and start actually implementing things or changing the view around.
Okay, so as you describe that, I picture some sort of little wizard in my head that's going to pop up and stub out some methods for me, stuff like that, maybe even at the class level. But something that's going to generate some more code for me such that I have less to write by hand.
Exactly. I mean, that's the goal. Less code to write by hand. And especially that code that something can figure out for you.
Is this something that I can use to stub out a new controller, maybe some views, and perhaps even some models that go along with that, after I've already created and begun working on my project? Or is this something that I only have access to when I say new project?
After you've started your project. Yeah, that's the idea, is that you open up your MVC project, you've already, you know, been working on it for a couple months, but now someone needs this additional thing displayed. You can just scaffold it up and then start working on it.
Now, you mentioned NuGet earlier, and it just so happens that last night I went to an informative session on that subject at my local .NET user group, and I now know at least that NuGet is not just the inside of a delicious candy bar. So what is it?
NuGet, NuGet, is essentially a package manager that integrates really well with Visual Studio. So a package manager, if you ever used a package manager on like Linux, it's very similar, except it's really geared towards just get things into my project. What you do is, and once you have NuGet installed, and I should point out that NuGet is not tied to the MVC framework at all. So you can use NuGet in Silverlight applications, console mode applications, Windows services. But so let's say you're just building a console mode application, and you decide that you want some sort of open source logger. Let's decide that you want Log4Net, but you don't have it on the system. So traditionally, what you'd have to do is go out and find the Log4Net homepage, download it, possibly build it, add it to your project, do some configuration, and then you're ready to go. With NuGet installed into Visual Studio, all you do is right-click that references node in Solution Explorer and say add package reference instead of add reference. And what it will do is go out to a RSS feed of available packages that are hosted by a site that Microsoft runs, but you can also have your own custom package feeds and package repositories on a network share, on a local drive. It'll go out there and it'll find a list of all the things that you can add a reference to. That includes things like AutoMapper, MockU, StructureMap, Log4Net, the CodeFirst CTP of the Entity Framework. All these things are out there. You just click on one of those. It will download it. It will analyze to see if that component has any dependencies. So for instance, you can say, I want to add a reference to nHibernate and use nHibernate. It'll pull down nHibernate. It'll look at the nHibernate package, see that nHibernate has a dependency on another framework called castle.core. It'll pull that one down too. It will plop them into your project, and you're off and running.
You know, for those few people who might be hearing about this for the first time, this might sound like a kind of no big deal sort of technology widget thingy. And I suppose at one level it is, but on another, after I spent some time using NuGet and diving in a little bit to how it works, this is cool. This is really a valuable thing for us as developers, and particularly if I happen to be in a corporate sort of more structured or locked down environment, the ability to provide my own feeds, that is the things, the libraries that we have approved for usage in our applications, that's a pretty big deal. And I wonder if we could spend just a moment talking about how that works, that private feed model.
So one thing you can do with NuGet is you can give it, you can tell it where to look for packages. By default, it's configured to look for a, you know, the official Microsoft feed. But you can also tell NuGet, no, look in C:// my packages, or you can point it to a network share, or you can point it to an OData feed that you have hosted somewhere inside of your firewall. And if you point it to something like a local directory or a network share, all you need to do is put the package files into there. Just copy them in. So you could download them from the official site, copy them into a local directory, tell NuGet to look in that local directory only, and that's the only packages you'll see when you say add package reference.
And if I remember correctly, I can look in different places with different priority levels. So in other words, if I want, say, Structure Map, I can go to my local company feed, what version of Structure Map are we using, get that one. If we don't have it in our feed, then it just goes out and gets latest off of sort of that master NuGet feed.
Right. You can prioritize. You can list multiple sources. It'll and use them all in a specific order, right?
Okay, so how hard is it to set up my own feed?
I haven't tried this yet, but I don't think it's terribly difficult. The entire NuGet project is on CodePlex as open source, and that includes the source code to the official NuGet gallery. Meaning, if you want your own feed and not just put packages in a network share, if you want your own feed, you could download the source code from CodePlex, build it, put it on a server that's running IIS, and you're 90% of the way there. Then you just need to put the packages in.
One of the things I noticed when watching how NuGet works is that it creates for me, when I do include something, a packages folder called packages right under my solution root folder, right in that folder.
Right.
And that struck me because I've got this habit, you know, for the last 20 years, when I include something in a project, typically what I'll do is create a folder called lib. And it just occurred to me that in one fell swoop, Microsoft has changed the word lib in my life, or dependency for many others, to packages. We're just going to see that now.
That's right. When you add a package reference with NuGet, by default, you'll have a packages folder at the solution level. And honestly, I'm not sure if that's something that you can change or configure. I don't think it is. But it's interesting because I recently was talking to Sebastian Lambla, who has an open source project called OpenWrap, which is essentially, he started this before NuGet was available, and it's essentially the same thing. It's a package manager for .NET. And I think this is one of the features that someone requested from OpenWrap, was because it essentially will do the same thing. It'll create a specific folder at a specific location that is particular to your project or solution and put all the packages in there. And he gave a lot of pushback to the idea of letting people configure their own folder, and, you know, convention is good.
You know, and that's why I'm willing to live the rest of my life as a developer with that packages folder, because from now on, anytime someone looks in my project, they're going to see that packages folder and they get it, right? We don't have to have that discussion about where you put your dependencies. We'll just all know that's where they go.
Yeah, I think that's good. Yeah. Simplifies things.
You mentioned OpenWrap, and, you know, that project's been around a lot longer than NuGet, and it had its own way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have that Visual Studio integration that we appreciate inside NuGet.
Right. And I think Sebastian's goal with OpenWrap was much broader than what NuGet is. I think Sebastian's goal for OpenWrap was to be a true package manager. If you want package management that works anywhere, not just something that's related to projects inside of Visual Studio, then that's what OpenWrap's going to be.
So if you want to install an add-on for your already installed application, for example, you might do that through...
Exactly. And, you know, OpenWrap even would be something that runs on a client's machine. So I'm building a desktop application and I deploy it. I might deploy OpenWrap out there to manage dependencies for my clients and pull down the latest bits for them.
I kind of can't believe there's so much to talk about with just adding references to my Visual Studio projects, you know, but there is also a console window. This is a PowerShell console window, it seems like, that NuGet can be used from.
Right. I think by default it's under View, Other Windows, and inside of there you'll find a Package Manager console, and that essentially opens up a window that has PowerShell loaded. And there are PowerShell commandlets for NuGet that let you do all the things that you could do with the UI. So list the available packages, add a package, uninstall a package, update a package. They're all there.
What struck me is that that really is a first-class PowerShell console window.
Yes.
Just so happens to include NuGet commandlets.
Right. When you're inside of there, you can list directories and... pipe commands in the SQL Server and all the things you do with PowerShell.
That right there is worth the price of NuGet admission in my book, you know? And I'm sure that you're going to tell me that there's been an alternative PowerShell integrated window available forever. And I just didn't know about it, so I didn't have it. But now that I've got it in NuGet, hey man, I'm happy.
Yeah, actually where I thought you were going with the question was you were going to talk about the plugin for Visual Studio that gives you a searchable add reference dialog box.
Oh, the window that we get through Power Commands.
That's in the Power Commands, right? That's pretty awesome.
Is there anything else in this whole big set of recent releases in the web space from Microsoft that you're super excited about?
Yeah, I've mostly been focused with the MVC framework. To be honest, it's the first release of MVC that I've been genuinely excited about. I was excited by the previous releases, but at the same time, I was always expecting them to be a little bit better than they were. Finally, with version 3, I think the framework and the product has finally started to show some signs of being mature and being together and being coherent.
Well, that sounds just basically like what we all know about releasing software, right? By the time we hit version 3... we're probably going to be having something that we can really sink our teeth into and something great.
That's true.
Okay, so what's my upgrade story? Let's say I have an MVC 2 application and maybe it's substantive in size and I want to do a conversion. Is there any love for me there?
Actually, this has been somewhat automated. There's a project on, I believe it's on CodePlex again, that will update your MVC 2 projects to MVC 3 projects. Which is mostly just the process of making sure that assembly references are correct and copying in some new jQuery scripts, but also little things like changing those project type GUIDs inside of the CS proj file. It'll take care of things like that. And there's also another project that I just found out about yesterday and haven't had a chance to try it out yet, but supposedly there's a project on CodePlex 2 that will convert ASPX views to Razor views. Yeah, so I want to try that out. The other neat thing, by the way, they did in MVC was they really embraced jQuery. So it used to be that if you wanted to use client-side validation or you wanted to use one of the HTML helpers that gave you an asynchronous postback on a form tag. I shouldn't say postback, but it is a postback. An asynchronous form tag. Then you needed the Microsoft AJAX libraries. Microsoft AJAX.js.
Right.
Which are kind of large and really not fully utilized if you're in an MVC project. So with MVC 3, they've redone everything so that all you need is jQuery. And if you want client-side validation, all you need is jQuery and the jQuery validation plugin and one additional little piece that just sort of transfers metadata between the MVC style into what jQuery validation plugin needs.
Ooh, I wonder, can I get a hold of any of the client-side stuff, jQuery plugins, etc., through NuGet now?
Actually, there are a couple JavaScript plugins and jQuery plugins that are listed as NuGet packages. That's right. And so what would happen if you use NuGet to grab those? And the one I'm thinking about, the one I've seen in there, is the jQuery templating plugin that Microsoft was behind for client-side data templating. It'll plop it into your scripts directory for you.
Oh, so it can put something in my project that doesn't go in that packages folder. It can actually put it where it needs to go inside my project for that package to work.
That's right. And actually, NuGet has some really interesting features once you go beyond just adding an assembly reference. You can, inside of a NuGet package, if you build one yourself, you can include some PowerShell scripts that will be executed when that package is referenced into a project. And inside of those PowerShell scripts, you can do things like get a hold of the Visual Studio automation object and inspect things about a project and, you know, look at things, how things are laid out. And you also have the ability to add code to a project. So I know, for example, let's say that I want to use Ninject as an inversion of control container. I can right-click on my references and say add new package reference, find ninject.mvc3, which is an implementation of that dependency resolver I was telling you about earlier for Ninject.
Right.
So not only will it bring down Ninject itself and add a reference to it, it will also bring down an implementation of that dependency resolver and add a reference to both of those assemblies. And then it'll also add a thing called app_start_ninject_something.cs into my project. And inside of there is sort of the boilerplate code that you need to instantiate and get Ninject up and running for your application.
Another thing I noticed when I added one particular tool to my web application is that I needed to do some configuration in my web config. And I suppose it will work in app config too. But if that's required of the assembly or plugin that I'm adding into my app, then there's an XSLT type transform that occurs that they can just shim all of that configuration stuff right into my web config. And I didn't have to go do all of that by hand either.
It's really cool. I like this tool a lot. It's going to be great. The only thing that worries me about it is that people are going to want to add lots of features to it. I hope one day it doesn't become a big, complicated monstrosity.
I can relate to that. Well, thanks for joining us on another great episode of the Pluralcast. Thanks, as always, go to those who provide music for the show, including the Judies, who you can learn about at WastedTalentRecords.com, and Patrick Lee, whose music you can actually download at PatrickLeeMusic.com. This has been your host, David Starr. Thank you for joining us, and I hope to see you in class sometime soon. No dogma is dogma. No dogma is dogma. What?
hit me. And now I realize.